getting you to give me first a kind of a quick autobiography, where you were born and when and how you got to Chapel Hill, and that's really where I want to
go. I was born in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in July the 1st, 1916. My father was a minister of the Christian Church at the time in Winston-Salem. He left his ministry a few years after that. He continued to preach occasionally, but he gradually lost his faith in the church and in religion finally. I grew up listening to him question his faith right the way through my childhood.
What do you think it was that made him finally? What was it about it that didn't work for him?
The first thing that didn't work for him was that he grew up in the Church of Ireland, which was the Episcopal Church, but flintier than the Church of England almost. He came to this country and met some people in the Church of Christ, but they were the more gentle, warm kind. And so he had a simple religion that was also warm and positive. And he was a school teacher and also went to Eastman School of Eastman School of Business in New England for 6 months and learned to write contracts and all that kind of thing. And dabbled in real estate. And then they encouraged him to go to college. So he went to college, I think he started when he was 28, and went to the University of Transylvania University, part of the University of Kentucky later. But it took him 8 years because he had his undergraduate degree and then his degree in theology, and learned Latin and Greek and so forth. Evidently he was very good. Got out of there at about 1908, because I think around that, because his first appointment was to Katie's.
Is that right?
Or second, but I'm pretty sure it was the first, when he came to Katie's. And they recognized as a person with education. And here again was a congregation that had a certain amount of gentility.
Yeah.
And were not the shouting, bickering kind of people that he found when he then got an appointment to a larger church in Winston-Salem. But it was doctrinally split. They were having arguments in the congregation. And I'm sure he saw the contrast between that and the Moravians we live near.
Right.
Because very soon after he came to Winston-Salem, he bought half of a double house in Salem.
In the village?
On South Main Street.
Yeah.
It wasn't a village then, it was just Salem. And so while we kept going to the Christian church on Sunday mornings, we would go to the Moravian church at night, and he loved the music and he liked the simple sermons and so forth. But we would have Bible reading every morning, and he would give us the various readings of the scripture as he knew it from Latin and Greek, and why this was that. He started questioning Adam and Eve, telling us it was a metaphor, a legend, a way of explaining the creation. And
just a meter reader.
And later on he started questioning the virgin birth, which of course was the crucial question.
Yeah.
And I can remember him talking with people who would come to visit us from the old congregation. and he was making them feel very uncomfortable. And I can remember as quite a small child sitting there thinking, "Daddy, keep your mouth shut. They're happy. Why bother them? You and I know this." But I think the most vivid time I remember was that he obviously was so disturbed by the music, the harsh kind of simplistic kind of music, and he missed the music of the Episcopal Church. He loved the music of the Moravian Church, and I was a boy singer, and so he decided I should go into the Episcopal choir, and so he arranged it. But he took me around the little Episcopal church they had at the time and showed me the stages of the cross windows and the crucifix and all of this. And he told me it was all idolatry. And I should remember that. And I remember a year later carrying the cross in front of the choir, feeling very proud of myself because I was the only person in that church who knew it was all idolatry.
So you grew up being a skeptic.
That's right. But a closet skeptic. There were certain things that we didn't talk with other people about because it would make us outcasts or different. And of course, no teenager wants to be different.
I could very easily follow this in another direction because this is, I have an interest in this for reasons other than my purpose here. And I would like to do it. In fact, I do want to take it one step farther just to ask you about your mother, because she would be my relative, blood relative. She was my grandmother's mother, sister.
Well, I remember very little of my mother. You know, she died.
She died. How old were you when she died?
Well, she died in, 22, I think. Well, I was just
6 years old.
Well, just 5 and a half, I think. Yeah. And so I remember surprisingly little of her. I remember her sitting next to me on the streetcar when we were coming back from the hospital where I'd had my tonsils out. I remember her leaning over the bathtub I remember only one or two other strange that I remember the funeral. Oh God, I remember the funeral very vividly.
Where was it, in Winston-Salem?
It was in Winston-Salem in our front parlor. And God, I think the most vivid memory are the women's kid gloves patting my head. You know, the women all wore these kid gloves, looking down on me. And also, one of the most touching scenes with my father was that the night she was laid in state in the front parlor, and my father taking me in to see her the night before, and I noticed that she was wearing her wedding ring, and he insisted that she be buried with the wedding ring. But
you never saw your grandparents, Kentucky grandparents?
Never saw them. That I recall.
Yeah.
I think I was taken to them early.
Before she died.
That's right.
Afterward, never.
No. The story is, and I'd be interested to find your version of it. The story, and of course you should talk to CAC, but the story that I have is that when Mother died, the relatives arrived for the funeral. I don't know how many came. But they had a plan that each of the children was to be taken by one or another of the aunts, with just the assumption that my father couldn't possibly look after them. And then there was the very severely handicapped child, Julia, who was You see, there was the four of us plus Julia, this severely handicapped child.
How old was she?
I don't know.
Well, where did she fit?
She was born before Libba.
Uh-huh. Was it Cack and then you and then?
No, Cack, Boney, uh-huh. Martha, then me, then Julia.
And then Libba.
Then Libba. And Julia, you know, finally had to be put into an institution, and she died there soon afterward.
Soon afterwards, as a child?
Yes, that's right.
Okay,
yes.
So she would have been under six.
That's right.
You were only six or five and a
that's
half.
That's right, yeah.
And so there were two children younger than you.
That's right.
And then two older, but not all that much older.
Well, Cack was born in 1910, so
in
she 10, was 6 years old.
She was 6 years
yeah,
old.
That's right.
She was 12 years old.
That's right.
And so, from the perspective of this Kentucky family, here are five children under 12, one of them severely handicapped.
That's right.
And
they had worked out this plan to take them. And they knew that my father was not well, that he no longer was had a church, that he was making his living by selling vacuum cleaners and brushes and renting some houses that he had built for blacks. You know, that's what we lived on most of the time, was the rental from these shotgun houses.
Is that right?
And how the hell he could make it. And of course it sounded, I'm sure to them, it sounded very logical. But he was very angry, according to what I've been told.
Mm-hmm.
And simply cut us off from any real contact with the Cady's people from then on, you see. Well, as they predicted, within less than 2 years, he had to find a place in the country for us. And so for 2 years, we lived in East Bend.
Where is that?
It's about 18 miles outside of Winston-Salem, 20 miles in Yadkin County.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent...
like a boarding?
Well,
a foster home?
For 2 years, he had a series of white housekeepers. Each one worse than the one before. Just didn't work at all. And I'm sure working with my father was no gift either, because he was not well, and he had a short temper and so forth. And so finally he found Mrs. Apperson, who, good-hearted old lady, and her daughter of about 22. She'd had a big family, she had a fairly big house in the country, and she took us. What he paid her, I don't know, and he'd come out every other weekend to see us on the bus.
Just the woman and her daughter?
And her daughter, in the house. And she took all of us, the four of us. And I do have very vivid memories of those 2 years, which you may want to record.
Did you go to school during that?
Oh, yes.
You started the school during that?
No, I started the first year. I went to... Central School in Salem. Salem Central School, the public school there.
Yeah.
So I had, Martha was 1 year ahead of me. And so I went to that school for 1 year and didn't learn to read, because I knew all the stories from Martha's time, so I could turn through the book and read.
Tell the story.
And I didn't learn to read. I got out to East Bend and that next year, and a peculiar thing had happened. The old school had burned, and they were building a new school on that property. So they rented an old house just near the Appersons, right across the way, in fact, and turned that into a school. It was about the time when North Carolina started subsidizing schools, county contributions to the schools, to try to improve them. And so counties got paid a certain amount per school day for the people who came. So the counties started enforcing the school leaving age, which was 14. So more than half my second grade were people between 12 and 14. And I saw pregnancies. What I learned in that second grade. By the way, the county was completely white. I don't think a black was allowed to live in that county. Mm. It was one of those white, counties. And also, they were raising teachers' standards. And so couldn't get the state subsidy if your teacher didn't have at least 2 years of college. Now, before this time, the schools had been operated by teachers who had finished high school and then had usually had a couple of summers of teacher training. And these were the country girls who really could control these classes. Mm-hmm. Instead, we got girls from Greensboro, the cities, mm-hmm. who'd had 2 years of college, maybe more. And they were having to live with the families in East Bend, mm-hmm. having to control these kids who are coming to school for the first time, who are as big as they were. And very touching remembrance. We were having a spelling bee. And on the board were all the places you moved if you spell the words right. We started at East Bend, and the goal was to get to Greensboro, where this teacher had come from. And, with the wood stove in the room, the second and third grade were in class together. Uh-huh. And again, I didn't learn to read. And
you were there 1 year or two?
Oh, 2 years.
And still didn't learn?
That's right. The first year, they, for some reason, my father wouldn't, that's crazy class business, he wouldn't let me wear overalls to school. Can you imagine the torture that was to have to wear short pants to school when everybody had, and the joy the next year when he allowed me to wear overalls to school, I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
Oh boy, I was in, but I didn't learn to read. And I think after 2 years he realized that Catherine, who really was had a lot of the burden of the family,
she was down 14,
was not getting what she should be getting out of the high school, because the high school was just starting there. He, I don't think, realized that I wasn't reading until I got back to town. And then he did absolutely the wrong thing. He found some baby books, to teach me to read. And he was trying to teach me to read, and I was stupid. And he lost his temper, and for almost the only time I can remember anything like corporal punishment, he threw the book at me. He was so distressed. And then, in fairly typical fashion, he turned his back on the truth and ignored the fact that I couldn't read. But I used to go with him to the library, because he loved to.
He was a real scholar.
Oh yes, and he loved the public library. And I started picking up Tom Tidwell, was like the Rover Boys books, Tom Tidwell books or something like that. They were, Tom Tidwell and the Dismal Stomps. Tom Tidwell goes to Sicily, whatever it is. And I stumbled into reading those things. And the next time, about 2 years later, this may be an exaggeration, maybe it was a little later than that, he found me reading Elma Gantry and was so absolutely outraged at the filth I was reading. And I'd been given it by the librarian, because I'd read Main Street and I'd read Babbitt. So, I was about 11 years old at that time. But how I got to Chapel Hill was interesting.
Let me interrupt and ask, when did your father die?
My father died in 1944.
So this is going to be on farther, quite a way on into the story. You all went back to Winston-Salem and lived in town then the rest of your school?
That's right. He brought us back the summer that I was 9. And we lived there until I went away. I went away to school, and we lived in South Main Street, the same house, until, I guess, I'm not sure when, Cack will have to tell you. Martha Boney married and moved to Ardmore, and Daddy moved in with her, but I don't have that chronology quite right, because you see, I was away all that time.
Yeah. Well, in the years...
No, I'm sorry. He continued to live in the South Main Street house until after I went away to the Army, because I visited him there.
I see.
No, so that... Maybe
okay, so you all went back to Winston-Salem and lived for a long time in the same house.
The same house, oh yes.
And during those years, he was selling vacuum cleaners?
Selling vacuum cleaners. He was selling, went into all kinds of strange business ventures. For example, he and some other people used to buy carloads of oranges, and they'd pull up to a railroad siding and people would come and buy the oranges. Mostly our income came from
the rental.
6 or 7 houses. He bought a number of pieces of real estate, little pieces, lot size, and he built wooden houses on them to sell, to rent to blacks. I visited them often with him. Sometimes he'd go to collect the rent, sometimes the people would come to his house to pay the rent. Each of them had a toilet out back, a flush toilet, but out back, not built into the house. No running water in the house that I recall. A faucet outside. They paid about $7 a week. I later figured out that they must have repaid the cost of those houses about every 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And so in effect, that's what we lived on.
Yeah. He never remarried.
He never remarried.
Never had, as far as you know, any other...
I just couldn't have imagined anything like that. In fact, I never thought about my father as a sexual person.
Uh-huh.
I just couldn't.
You just couldn't even.
Never even occurred to me until long after he died. Martha showed me a letter that he'd written mother that was far from explicit.
Yeah.
But
it's still a far stretch from your image of it.
A really personally affectionate letter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, the things that stick in your mind. I remember asking him something about a gift shop. And he said something about, wasn't it nice that people had a place they could buy things to bring home? And he mentioned his connections with Polite's Candy Kitchen, because he used to buy a gift to bring home to Mother after he'd been on the road.
George, he never went back to Ireland?
He never went back to Ireland.
Never had any further contact with his family there?
Yes, he had continuous contact with Aunt Anna. Aunt Anna and another sister were nurses.
They were his mother's or his father's sisters?
they were his, I'm sorry, my Aunt Anna.
Yeah.
They were his sisters.
They were his sisters.
His sisters, oh yes. They left Ireland and started a hospital in England. And they wrote some things about that. One of the sisters, they were both involved in a hospital in the First World War that went to France. And one of them died of radium poisoning. Mm-hmm. They were the first, among the earliest people to use radium. Mm-hmm. And Aunt Anna was a very faithful correspondent. She used to send us, I remember the rolled up magazines, the Illustrated London News, mm-hmm. and St. Nicholas every year, mm-hmm. the Mother Christmas edition.
Yeah.
And he and she wrote back and forth quite regularly.
Do you know why he came to this country? Was there some particular reason?
It was 1893, I believe it was, or two. Things were very bad in Ireland.
It was Irish, depression, potato famine.
Or? He was a son of a quote, good family, but had fallen on hard times. I mean, his father died in 1870. You know, then they immediately left the Aran Islands and went to Dublin, where there were the kind of poor relations of people there in Kenilworth Square. So he grew up in Kenilworth Square. And shortly after the war, I went back there and talked to some of the relatives about it, and there was some suggestion that he couldn't find a job, and the Bell House, the relatives of the Bell Houses, had come to this country and had a drugstore in Kissimmee, Florida, and they invited him to come over to work with them. And he had a passage on the boat, and something happened that didn't go through, and he came on not steerage, but on one place, you know, mm-hmm. everybody, but one of those big ships that left Cork, I guess it was.
Yeah.
Or, it might have been, yes, Cork, it must have been. But you went, instead of going to England, you went overland to Cork and then came around. But it's one of those ships that had lots and lots of Irish immigrants. Mm-hmm. Came to New York. He told us very little about that. He went through Castle Gardens, not Ellis Island, because I guess it was just the year before they transferred to Ellis Island. Mm-hmm. And he told me with some bitterness about being exploited by a fellow Irishman who met him at the dock and offered him a room in a rooming house that for supposedly a very cheap price, and it turned out to be full of bed bugs.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how he never liked, he always had uncomplimentary things to say about the Irish.
Is that so?
Oh, he was more English than the English.
Oh,
and anything that was good about Ireland was put there because of the English. He almost never talked about the Aran Islands. And he was very, very anti-Catholic. Very anti-Catholic. And we never understood why, of course.
Yeah.
To us, the Catholics were just that other, mm-hmm. another sect down the street.
Yeah.
When Johnny Wiggins was a Catholic, we didn't, right. we couldn't understand right. why.
Well, did he go to Kissimmee, Florida?
He went to, oh yes.
I mean, that was the first place he...
He went, then he got on the train and went to Kissimmee, Florida, where he worked with the Bell Houses. And by the way, we stayed in touch with the Bell Houses for many years after that. Because their daughter married somebody in Philadelphia, and they used to come visit us every year and send us Easter eggs and chocolate Easter eggs. He went to Kissimmee, and then became a school teacher at another place, if I remember it, in just a few minutes, northern Florida, where there was school only 6 months a year, but he'd had, you know, this public school education in Ireland, so he was educated.
Yeah, right.
And he was selected as a school teacher.
He must have been, what, 18 or so?
No, no. He was born in 1868. And...
well, he was 25 years old or so when
that's
he
right.
came to
that's
this
right.
country.
He was selected as a school teacher. And they had, the school was in the station house. Because it was there were only two trains a day. Otherwise it was sitting there empty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he got paid $20 a month, but he had to furnish the wood for the stove. And
this was in North Florida?
North Florida. I'll think of the name of the place in just a moment. And otherwise he worked on a farm. He evidently worked on the farm of the man of the family he lived with. Because he used to tell me how difficult it was to handle the horses and how cold it was in the morning and then how hot it was in the middle of the day and how cold it was at night and how cold that station was. But he was always very proud of the fact that he was a school teacher there. And those people were the people who made him converted him into the Christian church. And there were, I wish I knew the names and so forth, because they were obviously people who treated him with great respect. And that was something that was terribly important to Father all the time. He wanted to be treated with respect. He wanted, you see, I never saw my father without a collar and tie until I was about 18. And I remember the shock of seeing his naked arms.
Mm-hmm. I can relate to that. How did he get from from North Florida to Transylvania?
Well, Cat can tell you about it much better than I can, but he went to this Eastman Business School.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it was Eastman.
Up east,
yes, because he used to have in his library, he used to have picture brochures of places in New England, Connecticut, Rhode Island, where the school was.
Mm-hmm.
And he went there for a few months and learned this penmanship anyway.
Right.
It wasn't Palmer, it was and wrote beautifully all his life, and then became, you know, drew up contracts for people, that kind of thing. And they encouraged him to go to Transylvania to become a minister.
I see.
And I think, my assumption is that it was a man who should have gone into academic pursuits.
Yeah, right.
And this seemed to be a way to do it.
And so he ended up going from Florida, from Ireland to Florida, to New England, to Kentucky.
That's
he
right.
was this sort of...
That's right, but he went back to Florida after that, you see.
Oh, after Transylvania?
After Transylvania, oh yes, he went back, and evidently did fairly well because when he went into when he went to college, he had a fair amount of savings. And now where he accumulated the money to buy that land at Winston-Salem, I don't know, but I think he kind of squirreled it away.
Well, then how did he get from, if he went back to Florida, how did he then end up back at Cadiz?
Well, you see, Transylvania was the...
Like the theological...
That's right. So that's why he went there.
Yeah.
And when he graduated from Transylvania, he got this appointment.
Well, I thought you said he went back to Florida after
Transylvania. No, not after Transylvania.
No. Okay, so yeah, I can see how he'd get from Lexington to Cadiz.
That's right. That's where he got from that.
Yeah.
But CAC is going to be much more reliable than this tonight.
By that time, though, he's 30-some-odd.
Oh, yes. Yes, you see.
When he went to Cadiz.
That's one of the reasons why grandmother, whom I have nothing but negative pictures of her, that's why she was so much against
the marriage.
Here was a foreigner,
and
an old man.
Yeah.
But not in Irish terms.
No.
As you know, the typical Irish picture was that you don't marry until your mother dies.
Yeah.
You know, you go back home and look after your mother, and when she finally dies, then you marry somebody. If you haven't cooled the fires of sex with whiskey.
Right. And your father probably didn't think too much of her either, of Julia, Julia Crenshaw.
I don't know.
His mother-in-law.
He
I suspect he probably would not have.
Of course, he has great. He always had great admiration for the doctor.
Yeah.
But evidently, she was very much against the marriage, even though he was marrying a woman who was about to be an old maid. Mm-hmm. But she was.
Yeah. She was no spring chicken.
She was 26, wasn't she?
Yeah, I mean that's old.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think she was 26.
That sounds
yeah.
All right.
But she. Oh, yes, I have another very vivid memory of my mother standing at the bottom of the stairs. We had this big open stairway. strangely, it's architecture, the inside of this house. Standing at the bottom of the stairs, calling for my father. And she always addressed him as Mr. Stoney, or your father. I never heard my mother address him by his first name. Now,
what was his first name?
George.
His name was George?
Oh, yes. His name was George Henry Cashel. But it was always your father.
Or Mr. Stone.
Mr. Stone, yes.
You were going to tell me a minute ago about how you got to Chapel Hill.
Oh, how I got to Chapel Hill. For reasons which only other people can tell you, I was a part of an experiment to push people from the Central School. We went back, when I came back to Winston-Salem, we went to Central School, but they'd been moved to another building at that time. Accelerate us to go into high school in the middle of the year. So at the age of 13, I was in high school. And so even though I did miserably in high school academically, he kept promoting us. And so I finished high school in the middle of the year. 32, and then went back for another spring to learn typing and take some other courses, thank God. I had a paper route, and so I was independently wealthy. I mean,
I
had an income, which my sisters didn't have, and my other people did, and I mean, that was substantial.
Sure, yeah. In the Depression.
I'd always peddled papers or worked in a store or something, so I hadn't had to ask my father for any money since I was 10, and which I'm sure always made a difference with my sisters. Very difficult. But a fellow came by. I never thought about going to college. Just we couldn't afford it. Catherine had just been to Salem College for 1 year, and we couldn't afford it. She couldn't afford to keep on, and she was the bright one. She was a scholar.
Yeah.
And a fellow came by from Chapel Hill to talk to us in high school about college, you know, the recruiters. And so the counselors had us all in, and he told us about self-help, a self-help program. You could work your way through. And I listened. But I had no idea that I was going to. But I was going to work in a cotton mill, a hand knitting mill, because I was giving a free paper to a foreman there who told me that he was going to find me a job in cotton. But sure, he could get me a job. I had no idea what it was like working in the mill, but it was going to be a job. Of course, secretly, I was going to be a writer. All the way through high school,
really?
I was, oh, goodness, I was going to be the next Thomas Wolfe. And I wrote, and I dreamed about all of this. This is what, that was my secret dream, no question about it. So it didn't matter what I was going to do, it would be an adventure, you see, that I could write about.
Sure.
I had no idea what it was going to be like in the cotton. But he told me he was going to get me this job. And it was going to start on September the 1st, it would be in the place opened up. I'd been giving him this free paper for months and months and months. And so I actually trained in my replacement. And I'm sure I bragged about it when I got the job. And when came September the 1st, he told me that another foreman's son had gotten the job. And I was so embarrassed that I took $47, my savings, out of the bank, and went to Chapel Hill,
having to save face.
No idea how I was going to stay there. And I went to the
YMCA. This in the fall of 32?
That's right. Fall
of 33.
33, fall of 33. Yeah, that's right, fall of 33. And I went to the headquarters for self-help, which was at the YMCA. You've seen the, you know, the, you've been to Chapel Hill,
yeah.
You know, right? To the west of the south building, that little open plaza.
Yeah.
To see this guy, whose name I can't recall now. And there were a whole bunch of fellas milling around, and I found that they had all been asked to come there because they were going to work in the dining hall, Swain Hall. And they were probably 2 weeks ahead of school. Would come to scrub the floors down and clean the place up and get everything going for the school. And they all had places. You worked 3 hours a day for your food,
mm-hmm.
and that was that. Well, I didn't have a, I wasn't among them. You know, my name wasn't on the list. But I just went along with them. And started scrubbing and started washing dishes, started eating, and only 3 weeks later did they find that I wasn't on the list, but hell, I've been working.
Yeah, so you were.
And so I was right in there. And I found that you could get a place in a professor's house working an hour a day,
yeah.
Which was, you know, mowing the lawn or mm-hmm. looking after the kids or whatever it was. And so I got a place in the professor's house.
Yeah.
So I had my room and my board.
Yeah.
And then I found that tuition, I think, was $25 a quarter, something like that. There were three quarters, you had the mm-hmm. quarter system. But you didn't have to pay it at the beginning, you only had to pay it when you took your exam. You couldn't take the exam if you didn't pay it. So I was in school. And it was what we now call open enrollment, that is academically. Because the theory was that anybody who had a certificate from a valid high school in North Carolina should be able to get into the university. Even though the university then would make you take competency exams, and if you couldn't pass those, you took remedial classes for which you didn't get credit.
Yeah.
But you were in Chapel Hill, and you gradually caught up. So I think at least two of the four classes I was taking as a freshman were remedial, even though I came from a better high school. But I was in school. And at the end of the term, by that time I was also working for the self-help department, washing windows and pouring concrete. I think I made 17 cents an hour pouring concrete, the hardest work I ever had. And I couldn't quite pay my bills, so I took my typewriter down and pawned it with Abernathy's bookshop. And that became a ritual after a while. Ab just gave me the money and I'd pay it back. And I was there for 4 years.
Yes. Did you not go back to home much to live? I mean, did you ever go back there to live after that?
Oh, no, never went back to live. I visited, you know, fairly regularly.
Yeah, and but that was effectively your departure from the family.
Oh, yes, sure.
Yeah.
A very happy memory of my father was 2 years later, I think it was. I stayed in Chapel Hill and had a job looking after a paternity house that was going to be empty. And he came down and spent a week with me. And it was the only time I can ever remember us having a really companionable time together.
Like at the end of your sophomore year or something like that?
And I took him to the library. Mm-hmm. I took him to the bookshop.
He must have loved that.
It was hot as hell.
Yeah.
But I had this whole house. And, you know, he came down on the bus. And I can remember that was one of the few times when we really had a good time, a meaningful time together.